Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're taking a look at three beaten up stocks. Do they have what it takes to turn it around? Motley Fool Money starts now. I'm Dylan Lewis, and I'm joined over the airwaves by Motley Fool analyst Jim Gillies. Jim, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for the invite, Dylan.
Today, we're going to check in on a few companies that have a bit of a tough outlook and whether investors should have them on their watch list. The first two come to us by way of the news, Jim. And the first one we'll discuss is New York Community Bancorp. Shares at their lowest level since 1996 after the regional bank disclosed something that investors never want to hear, and that's a material weakness in a filing. Jim, this is also a company that's had CEO changes, downgrades of its debt recently from Moody's and Fitch. Seems like a lot of things swirling here against NYCB.
Well, and you've also, you've left out the most important part, Dylan. This is a bank. I know, it's. I like to state the obvious. This is a bank, and banks depend on the confidence of investors and, more importantly, the confidence of depositors. Now, good news is no one has ever had a mass run on a bank and pulled their deposits from a financial institution at a time when they need trust, right? Oh, wait, that happens all the time. In fact, that happened a few times last year. The name Silicon Valley Bank or First Republic, I believe it was.
We're coming up on the anniversary, Jim.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, I didn't get you anything. I'm sorry. But, you know, I happy anniversary to all who celebrate. I have many investing rules, but one of the investing rules that I have when dealing with financials, if something starts to look like a bit of a contagion or basically once there's like a more than a couple pieces of bad news, all the bad news that's come out about this bank, you know, the downgrade, the debt problem, material weakness, I would have hit the sell button so fast you're not, you know, your head would spin. And the reason is because they can't. Silicon Valley Bank gives a wonderful example, okay? Silicon Valley Bank from a year ago went from, hey, we're raising capital because we might be sort of kind of insolvent. We're going to raise capital and sell these securities to dead in under 48 hours. I'm not saying that's what New York Community Bank is, but I am saying, you know,
things move very quickly in the financial sector.
Things move very quickly. Lowest level since 1996 sounds bad, you know, and my rule is, with a financial, with inherent leveraged companies, you know, leverage 10 to 1 or 20 to 1 or whatever, inherently leveraged financial institutions that require the confidence of depositors and shareholders, I'm out, I'm gone, and then I'll do the work to see if I overreacted and if I should get back in or not. But and it's almost like it's the same principle as if you were to engage in such practice. I don't recommend it most of the time, but shorting a stock. Okay, shorting a stock can be very profitable. It can be a very good thing. But the number one rule of shorts I learned very early on, 20 odd years ago, something starts moving against your position, close it immediately, then go figure out why. Like just like don't be a hero. You can always get back in if you need to, but get out of the way, then ascertain, wait for the dust to settle, wait for the fire to die down, whatever metaphor you want to use. So I look at this company and I'm like, yep, lowest level in almost three decades. And I say, well, why would I chase this down? There's no shortage of banks I can go out and buy, right? Or and I've even got a couple of small regional banks that have been taken down by some of the negative news that's come out the last few weeks. But like one is a plain vanilla mortgage lender out of Ohio, you know, hotbed of the housing bubble, I suppose. And the other one is a tiny community bank in the Pacific Northwest that's being bought out by another somewhat larger community bank in the Pacific Northwest that probably has some price support below it. I think they're being bought around $23, stocks around $21 at the time. I would, if I was in the market for you know, small regional banks or small community banks, I wouldn't be looking at NYCB. I'd be looking in areas where, you know, the banks, they've long stuck to their knitting. They haven't done anything terribly controversial, good capital ratios, and just boring. Again, who doesn't get excited about plain vanilla home lending in Cleveland, Ohio, right?
So, Jim, it sounds like for you, NYCB is not even approaching watch list consideration.
Nope.
All right, our second beaten up name that we're going to talk about on today's show also comes by way of the news, and that's Stitch Fix. Shares down 18% after the company's second quarter results missed revenue estimates. Losses were wider than expected, and the company's guidance was revised down as well. Jim, this is a business that, you know, there's no secret that it's running into issues and has had issues for quite some time. We're about 9 months into new CEO Matt Baer's time at Stitch Fix. And he came over with a pedigree of working in customer relationships, digital officer over at Macy's. What do you want to be seeing from Baer and the team there to be interested in this company?
I've been unenthused. I'm sorry. I want to talk about something that's where I'm happy. I don't want to be the guy that craps on everything. But unfortunately,
I'll give you that chance later.
Thank you. Thank you. I feel that that's kind of what we're going here. So sorry, fools. Stay for the third ticker, I suppose. I am reminded of the Buffettism of when a business with a reputation of mediocrity meets a manager with a reputation for brilliance. It is usually the reputation of the business that persists. I think this is a failed business. I think it was a shameless cash grab by the people who brought it public. I don't know that Matt Baer can do anything, frankly, that will make me excited here when you see things like revenues falling 18%. They're calling for the next quarter to be down 20% plus minus. The full fiscal year, they're calling for 20% plus minus. Adjusted EBITDA. Remember, EBITDA is an adjusted accounting measure. It's not a real accounting measure, okay? And now, apparently, in the last few years, we've all decided to do adjusted numbers. I thought that was the analyst's job anyway. But adjusted EBITDA, which translation as we're going to remove everything that we can be perceived as bad so we can try to show some sort of a positive number. An adjusted EBITDA margin of 1-2% for fiscal 2024. They're halfway through the fiscal year. There's no cash generation. People have abandoned their services. I don't know that there's anything that would get me interested here. If you can show me a path to real and sustained free cash flow generation, and then CEO Matt Baer starts intelligently deploying the cash that they generate, and by that I mean, I don't think they have any debt. I think they have a bunch of cash, so that's fine. But like, it's a CEO's job is to do capital allocation. That's literally in the resume, right? There's not really much you can do, actually, with capital allocation. It's really only five choices. You can reinvest the business for growth while this thing's dropping 20% a year, so I'm not too sure about the utility of that. You can pay off debt. They don't have any debt, thank goodness. Financial risk, at least, is not a thing here yet. You can pay dividends and or special dividends. You can buy back stock. Well, but for buying back stock, to be reasonable, you have to be... You should be buying it at a perceived discount to intrinsic value. I know there's a lot of companies that ignore that last part, but play with me here. And then I suppose you can make acquisitions. I just call this a failed business, right? So, you know, failed business goes out and acquire. Like, I don't know that there's anything here that would get me excited. And I'm going to point out the stock is down, what, 95% in the past couple years?
Yeah. It's been an absolute massive sell-off.
Yeah. Boy, I want to be sunnier than I am right now, but I'm not. I'm sorry. I would have no interest in this thing, and I don't know how you'd get me to a position of interest.
All right, well, I'm going to give you the opportunity to be a little sunny here as we wrap up, Jim. The News Ferry brought us those two as an opportunity to check in on businesses that were struggling. I'm going to get outside the news cycle a little bit here, and I want to get a sense from you on a business that you're excited about that maybe doesn't have the narrative running its way, or maybe is more of a turnaround play in a lot of investors' eyes, but you think has a great path forward out of that.
So I'm going to give you a bit of an oddball one, or one that's probably not very high up, in most foolish investors' thinking. A company called Prog Holdings, very weird, P-R-O-G, all capital, of course, ticker symbol P-R-G on the New York Stock Exchange. This is the home of Progressive Leasing, not to be confused with Progressive Insurance, which provides, and I quote, web-based lease-to-own financing programs to credit-challenged customers in order to facilitate the purchase of big-ticket items.
I'm going to need you to unpack that just a little bit, Jim.
So imagine you are, you want to buy a new, living room set, couch and chairs, but you don't have the coin. You go to a store, you say, I'll buy it by rent to own, what have you. Progressive Leasing, aka Prog Holdings, they provide the financing for those types of leasing that you're going to get at these various places that where Progressive allows the business to take hold. This is an interesting company. It spun out, or rather, actually. So there's a company called the Aaron's Company. Okay. And about three and a half years ago, Aaron's, which is basically like the showroom for the rent-to-own furniture, Progressive and Aaron's were together. And Aaron's spun off. Aaron's spun off the Aaron's group and then changed their name to Prog Holdings, retained Prog. And Prog Holdings, again, is the leasing thing. They promptly went out and they said, okay, we make a lot of cash. We've got a lot of cash we can deploy. We have no debt at the time. So they went out and borrowed some money and they bought a bunch of stock back. And they've continued, they bought like, $600 million worth of stock back or what have you. And they've continued to buy about $30 million a quarter. This, and just put it in perspective, $30 million a quarter, Prog Holdings is a $1.4 billion company. Okay, so $30 million is actually a real thing.
It's material.
Yeah, it's $120 million a year, right? And they're doing it pretty... they're using it pretty good. They did that right before the credit cycle kind of turned against them. Okay. Credit markets have gotten a little more, as interest rates went up, people got a little more tentative about the type of borrowing they wanted to do. Borrowing moves in cycles. And, so that initial $600 million of stock purchases probably wasn't the best use of time or money. But since then, they have continued to repurchase. They have, since being separated from Aaron's, they've taken down 36% of their stock. They just, in their most recent quarter, just initiated a dividend, 12 cents a quarter. It's about 1.7% yield, I think, today. They do, in the most recent quarter, they were a little dour and said, here's our guidance. But then they said, our outlook, and I'm quoting here, assumes a difficult operating environment with continued soft demand for consumer durable goods, end quote. They kind of gave a bit of a dour picture. Sort of like Stitch Fix. The thing about their dour picture that I think is different from Stitch Fix's dour outlook is, again, credit moves in cycles. And you want to see a company, first of all, they're swimming in cash and capital. That's not a big deal. In 2023, they made my estimate, the way I calculate, they made about $167 million in free cash flow. Again, it's a $1.4 billion company. That's pretty good. I think they're going to do about another $160 million this year. The dividend's going to consume about $21 million, leaving the rest of it, $35 million a quarter for buybacks, which management is all but proclaiming from the rooftops. That's what they're going to do. Stocks trading at around 10 times free cash flow. And again, the funny thing about cyclical companies or companies exposed to a cycle, in this case, the credit cycle, eventually things turn. And when it turns and results actually jump up, they might have only 50% of the shares outstanding from the time they came public, or rather separated from the Aaron's Corp. So you're kind of playing a long game here. When will the credit cycle turn? I don't know. It'll probably be a Tuesday, but is that Tuesday next week, or is that Tuesday in a year and a half from now, right? Like, you don't and can't know, and that's okay. The point is, it's the company making a lot of cash, deploying that cash in the service of shareholders, trading for a more than reasonable bottom of cycle price. That I find very interesting.
I think that's a perfectly sunshiny type take to wrap us up here, Jim.
I do try.
thank you for bringing that stock and for bringing the methodology behind it to listeners today.
No problem.
Hey, Hey, it's Motley Fool Money co-host Dylan Lewis here. If you're listening to us, it's because you love following the stock market and learning about business stories. If you're looking to keep learning and unlocking your potential, then you should check out the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast produced by our friends over at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the Webby Award-winning best business podcast that's received nearly 43 million downloads and is the number one career podcast in 95-plus countries, so you know it's worth your time. Each week, host and Stanford lecturer Matt Abraham sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to hone and develop your communication skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, to keeping your nerves in check while speaking, to being more persuasive. Whether you're working on your elevator pitch or planning an important meeting, strong communication skills are important in business and life in general. That's why you'll hear from pros like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, as well as speechwriter, best-selling author, and friend of the Fool, Dan Pink, on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more available on the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast. So what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. Coming up, Motley Fool Money's Travel Week continues. Allison Southwick and Robert Brokamp talk about trends in travel and tips if you're trying to avoid the crowds and fees next time you step on a plane.
It's Travel Week here on the show, and while we do love us some travel-related stocks here at The Motley Fool, why bother investing if you don't get to see the world with the returns you generated? So let's talk about travel trends for 2024. What's in and what's out?
Let's start with one trend that's in: music tourism.
Yep, this is another trend you can thank Taylor Swift for: musical tourism, or called gig tripping. As fans of T-Swift discovered, it's cheaper to just take whatever Eras Tour tickets you can get and then fly there, even if it's in another country. The New York Times shared one specific story of a woman and her daughter from San Diego who, instead of driving 3 hours to Los Angeles and paying $1,900 for tickets, they just got tickets to the Mexico City show and paid less all in for hotels and flights, and they got to see a cool city in the meantime. I personally have a friend who is taking her family to Paris and Germany to see Taylor Swift because those are the tickets they were able to get. Bro, you are shaking your head in disbelief.
I can't believe it. I can't believe it.
Yeah. Now, of course, Swifties didn't invent the idea of traveling to see a band. I see you, Fish fans and Deadheads, but there is something a bit unique here about the travel roulette of saying, I'll get tickets where I can and worry about the rest later. So is this just a flash in the pan Swiftonomics trend? We should probably do a whole episode on Taylor Swift economics, by the way. Or is this one trend sticking around a bit longer, unlike watching football? I mean, who even talks about that anymore? Am I right?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to a trend that's out: overcrowded destinations.
Every year, Fodors makes a list of destinations you should skip. So Venice tops the list in 2024, but it also includes Athens, Mount Fuji, and Lake Superior, among many others. Fodors isn't saying they hate these places. They actually love them. But over-tourism not only makes them crowded, it's also taking a huge toll on the environment. So it's truly a case of nobody goes there anymore because it's too crowded. And you can find their complete go and no-go lists on their site, which of course brings us to our next trend.
Well, I'll tell you what's in: fees for entry.
That's right. An inn that maybe we wishes was out. Venice, which was on the verge of being considered an endangered city by UNESCO, will begin charging visitors €5 for an entry fee starting in April. Bali just started charging visitors about $10 a day to help pay for cultural programs and cleanup costs. And Amsterdam will be imposing the largest tourist tax in Europe in 2024, upping the tax on hotel rooms from 7% to 12.25%. Iceland is also pondering a tax in 2024 for visitors, but has yet to set a price. So all of these places are getting so over-touristed, and you're paying more to visit them, which brings us to our next trend.
Yeah, and this one I think is kind of funny, and it's an in-trend of dupe travel.
Yep. 2024 is the year of dupe travel. That's according to Expedia. Instead of visiting the over-touristed and likely more expensive locales, you can find recommendations online for places that are similar, just less crowded and less expensive. For example, Expedia says, instead of Santorini, go to Paros, Greece. Instead of Seoul, go to Taipei. Instead of Geneva, go to Quebec City, Canada. These recommendations and more can be found on Expedia's Dupe Travel 2024 report, and then also all over social media like TikTok and Instagram. Now, some of the recommendations are a little laughable, like the New York Times saying, instead of going to Paris for the Olympics, you can go to Cleveland or Indianapolis. These cities are hosting the Olympic swim team trials and the Pan America Masters Games. So yeah, Indianapolis, the Paris of Indiana. You'll hardly notice the difference.
All right, let's talk about the ins and outs of fees and fares.
Yes, fees and fares. United, American, Alaska, and JetBlue all raise their prices to check a bag by about $5 to $10 more. Why? Because they can, and it's a huge moneymaker for them. Airlines pull in over $5 billion with a B dollars annually from checked bags, according to the Department of Transportation. Southwest, however, is the outlier, according to CNBC. They allow customers to check two bags for free, and their COO says that's the way it's going to stay. When it comes to booking flights, Kayak says domestic airfare will be down 16%. International airfare will be up 10%. And Kayak recommends booking international travel 8 months out for the lowest fares. You can also try to save money by traveling during shoulder season months, which are March to early May and September to early November. If you must travel during peak times, such as spring break, may the travel gods have mercy on your wallets.
Ain't that the truth? All right, let's move on to our final trend, and it's one that's in whatever's on your TV.
Yes, another trend spotted by Expedia is people wanting to visit a place after watching a TV show or movie. For example, the first two seasons of HBO's White Lotus drove a 300% increase in travel demand for Hawaii and then Sicily. FX's The Bear even spurred a 45% gain in searches for travel to Chicago. And it's not like they even show a really glamorous side of Chicago. So what TV shows and movies are going to get people off their couches or at least looking up flights on their phones? Well, White Lotus is back and based in Thailand. Season 8 of Outlander will send people running for the Scottish Highlands, and Gladiator 2 will be set in Malta, which I can attest to is a lovely place with phenomenal food. So if you want to avoid the crowds, save those places for another year. All right, well, before we go, let's leave you all with our own travel recommendations. Bro, what is your hidden gem that you would like to recommend to listeners?
I have a few thoughts about this. First of all, Quebec, great place to visit. And if you were like us driving up the East Coast, like I did with my family, we stayed at a fun family resort type place in Vermont and then went on to Quebec. So that was a great visit. It's been a while since I've been there, but I think Central and Eastern Europe are still, if you're looking for lower prices and smaller crowds, that's the place to go. Two places that I've been to that I really liked. One is Karlovy Vary, which is a spa town about 2 hours east of Prague. And then Krakow in Poland, which is a lovely old town. A little harder to get to, but a lot of World War II history there. And then the final thing I'll point out is that my daughter got married in Rome last summer. And I'll just second that, boy, if you go to the big places in the middle of summer, it's just crowded, crowded, crowded. But what she and her husband now do is basically they're digital nomads all over that area of the country. So they have worked from Spain, Turkey, Cyprus. They'll eventually be going to Africa. And they've been able to live on a smaller budget than what it costs them to live in the States through all kinds of travel hacks. So, for example, right now, they're living rent-free in a London suburb, house-sitting and pet-sitting for an older couple who went on vacation, which is just an arrangement they found through a website. So, definitely lots of possibilities to travel a little cheaper if you can find them.
Well, my recommendation is a little island in the Inland Sea of Japan called Naoshima. This is an island that I believe the story is, and I'm probably going to mess this up, so everyone write me if I, and who knows better. Essentially, this gentleman was born on this small sort of fishing island in Japan. He later left and became a bajillionaire, and he decided to return to the island and turn the whole place into sort of a destination for art. There's architecture by Taro Ando. There are a few very big galleries like the Chichi Museum. You can see a couple of Kusama pumpkins and go up and hug them and get your super trendy pictures taken with them. They have a room full of Monets, which is really cool. And one of my favorite parts about this island is that they took in the village, I believe like 7 different houses, and they gave each house to a different artist. And so you can walk around the town and then just pop into a house, and the whole house is an art installation. And so it's just a very cool island dedicated to great art. It's not necessarily super easy to get to, but I highly recommend it.
As always, people on the program may own stocks mentioned, and The Motley Fool may have formal recommendations for or against, so don't buy or sell anything based solely on what you hear. I'm Dylan Lewis. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow.